Welcome to the Product Podcast by Product School. Here's a preview of today's talk.
What's your vision? It's really what's at the bound of what's imaginable to while still speaking to customer needs. So it's really kind of pushing the envelope, yet in the context of understanding what your customer needs really are. You don't want it to be too out there, too fantastical, because otherwise it's not actionable and you can't really execute on it. On the other hand, you don't want it to be too specific or something you're already doing now, because that doesn't really leave room for growth and iteration. So definitely worth spending some time here. And it seems cheesy when you're brainstorming what the vision is for a product, because it inevitably, in my view, ends up sounding kind of cheesy, right? Like, I want to change the world doing this and that. I want to make the world a better place with these things, right? And that's okay. It's good to set ambitious goals. It's unlikely that you're going to solve world poverty, but it's likely that by having a vision that actually sets you up at the shoulders of giants, that you're actually going to achieve something great.
In this podcast, we teach our listeners valuable lessons about product management and transform them into thinking like a product manager. We teach product management, coding, data analytics, and blockchain in 14 campuses worldwide, including San Francisco, New York, and Seattle. You can find more information at productschool.com. Join our Slack community of 25,000 professionals to network and stay tuned for our upcoming events.
If you want to take anything from the presentation, take away the slide, right? Vision informs strategy. Strategy is about your customers, your business, competitors, and the macro environment of what business you're actually operating in. And all these things inform the roadmap. So what's your vision? It's really what's at the bound of what's imaginable to while still speaking to customer needs. So it's really kind of pushing the envelope, yet in the context of understanding what your customer needs really are. You don't want it to be too out there, too fantastical, because otherwise it's not actionable and you can't really execute on it. On the other hand, you don't want it to be too specific or something you're already doing now, because that doesn't really leave room for growth and iteration. So definitely worth spending some time here. And it seems cheesy when you're brainstorming what the vision is for a product, because it inevitably, in my view, ends up sounding kind of cheesy, right? Like, I want to change the world doing this and that. I want to make the world a better place with these things, right? And that's okay. It's good to set ambitious goals. It's unlikely that you're going to solve world poverty, but it's likely that by having a vision that actually sets you up at the shoulders of giants, that you're actually going to achieve something great. So looking at some visions, IKEA, to create a better everyday life for many people. Simple enough, to the point. YouTube, to give everyone a voice and show them the world. Again, it's simple and understandable, it's concise, but it sets you up to having a strategy that is informed by this vision that unites the team, engineers, UXers, product, and the business partners that you're operating with. So you don't want to be too specific for the product to the products, for it to be something that they offer today already. And you also don't want it to be something that's can be definitely defined, right? I cannot definitely define give everyone a voice and show them the world. It's entirely subjective. But you get a sense of what a product vision is. Now, you want to take that and apply it to product strategy. This is what this is all about. The first thing is to identify what the future state of the product or the business ought to be and create the pathway to get there. I'm going to go through all the four kind of major categories that will inform this process. But before I go there, I just to reiterate, the product strategy is all about how you define your target market and the methods to achieve your business goals, right? So it might entail building a single product. It might entail managing a portfolio. But it's the collection of the things you need to do to achieve the vision. Oops. Okay. And then finally, the roadmap, right? When you ask product managers what is the core thing that they do, 76%, I believe, say their job is to set a roadmap. And setting a roadmap is not easy. I always get caught up when setting a roadmap because I get a little too future detail oriented and I start getting into this kind of analysis paralysis, like, oh my God, how many engineering months is this going to cost? Is this really bottlenecked by something else? Or what are the dependencies? And that's okay. I think that I put this as a last step. When those products and features will be released is not central to the problem. The things that matter here are what you need to build to realize the vision that you've set and who is responsible for building those things. Making sense so far? Great. So diving right in, product strategy. It's about your customers, competitors, the business, and the macro environment. And I'll go through each one, and then we're going to actually talk a little bit about the resources that you may use to actually make these informed decisions in each of these core areas. So of course, customers. This is, you know, business management 101. Who are they? Who are your customers? You really need a strong understanding of who your customers are, how they use the product or how they might use the product, what products that they may be using today that may complement or substitute the thing that you are trying to build. And of course, you have to be willing to adjust as you get feedback. And by adjust, I just mean adjust your notion of who a customer is. And I'm actually kind of wrong in saying customer in the singular. It's customers, right? The most powerful thing you can do is to cohortize your customers into personas, right? I'm sure you've all read about this. The notion of the persona of someone who has a name, an age, hobbies, interests is really, really powerful. So if you can distill the essence of who your customers are into core personas, four or five broad varieties, then that's going to be really, really useful. For example, in YouTube Music, my team, we found that the core customer is the so-called convenience streamer. And this is after a lot of research. We narrowed it down. We probably spent as much time on the name as we did on the actual research. But the convenience streamer is the following person. They want music at the right moment, at the right time. They don't care about discovery that much, and they are willing to pay for it. They don't care about their collection, right? And this all starts making sense, and it really, really informs our product, right? When we start thinking, well, who are our competitors? We've got Spotify and Apple Music. You've got different power users for different types of products that you're building. And so we find that convenience streamers are more lean back, yet demand a connection to their favorite artists. That's why I'm doing my job, right? Spotify doesn't have that. They don't need to have that because they address other needs through features like Discover Weekly, right? So types of research you can do, obviously you can do qualitative research, quantitative research. By qualitative, I'm really talking about the sorts of things where you can do a focus group or an interview and kind of distill those insights more qualitatively. In terms of quant, my favorite is to just really take 1.5 billion users and see how patterns start to emerge. In my opinion, that's a lot more powerful, but don't, at the same time, I fall into the trap of focusing solely on the quantitative elements of users when actually just talking to someone can be just as fruitful. So again, why they use your product, how do they use it, what do they use alongside it, and what are specific usage patterns? These questions are not limited for the entrepreneurial process that you might undergo when starting something. This is something you should keep asking yourself, no matter how old the company or the product is. I think there is bound to be, as we'll see later, an evolution in the types of users they may use your product. So, you know, with Google, you might expect everyone to use Google Search or Maps. There's no single power user, easily identifiable user. But in YouTube, you know, it went from being something that was pretty core for, you know, the 24-year-olds back in 2005, the early kind of internet natives, to kind of Gen Z, right? People who were born with beauty and makeup tutorials, who were born watching video game streamers. And so that's really the core of our audience. And by the way, they're not American. 80% of the audience is not outside of the US. And so, you know, we got to really step back and not have tunnel vision. when defining who our customers are, especially at a global scale. Now, your competitors. You got to find them. You got to categorize them. You got to understand their product, understand their distribution, their business models, right? How they make money, their strategy, and their history. In the strategy team, this was probably the most central part of my role, is to really have a very solid understanding of who was doing what and what they were motivated by. And this actually is surprisingly a qualitative assessment as much as it is a quantitative one. What I mean by that is sometimes product vision is set so strongly by those who are at the helm of the company, like Tim Cook and Apple, that you've got to understand who someone like Tim Cook really is, or who someone as, you know, like Elon Musk, as erratic as he might be, what he actually has in mind with his global, you know, plan for world domination, how these things actually, you know, trickle down into actual product road mapping and execution. And I'll go a little bit about later on about how kind of how you can actually do all this. In terms of business, how you or how you currently or will in the future make money is one of the most important things you can determine. And product strategy really just describes one of these core areas, describes how you will make money and how you will achieve your business goals. This is all very dependent on the context in which your product is being built. There are things that may be on 100% maintenance mode. There are things you may be put on that are in aggressive growth mode. And there are things that you might be put on that just are on a, I don't know, they were released 2 years ago, there's healthy growth, but growth isn't necessarily your key issue right now. And so how you make money often changes, the idea of how you might make money is very much dependent on where you are in the product or business lifecycle. By the way, I realize I say product slash business lifecycle is interchangeable. In many ways they are, and a lot of these things can apply to broad business strategy as they could be applied to product strategy. But my point here is whether or not you pursue an ad-supported business model or a subscription business model very much depends on the kind of growth curve that you're looking for, whether you want rapid acquisition and then kind of convert those into paying subscribers. Or by the way, you don't have to do either of those, right? You got tons of fascinating business models that are emerging with lots of new tech that kind of turn everything on their head. You don't necessarily have to sell data to make money. So it's just worth thinking about all these things and how what you're really optimizing for, and just keeping in mind that what you're optimizing for today doesn't necessarily have to be what you're optimizing for 5 years down the line. The most important thing, arguably, is the macro environment. And I think this is what strategy really is all about. And ultimately, it can be as simple as just you being an interested product manager. And by interested, I mean what's going on in the world around you. There are lots and lots of things happening that will for sure have an impact on your product at some level or another. And what you do is highly dependent, or should be quite dependent, on how these kind of forces are at play. How much are emerging markets growing? Which emerging markets that you're targeting are actually growing fastest, right? Do I care more about Brazil, Indonesia, Mexico, India, China? Why or why not? You know, maybe some of these places have better broadband penetration. Maybe some have more appetite for a larger portfolio of monthly subscriptions. There's very unique market dynamics in each of these places to justify going really, really deep and doing some serious research into who your users are in each of these particular places. One interesting kind of piece of evidence for this is just to see how you always have weird kind of pockets of heavy usage in the most unexpected places. If you remember Orkut, the social media platform from about a decade ago, was really, really big in Brazil. That's it. It was only big in Brazil and nowhere else. It failed spectacularly everywhere else. Path, the one that just announced bankruptcy last week, it was basically an alternative to Facebook that at some point actually had pretty good traction, 10 million users and growing really quickly. Path was subsequently purchased by some random conglomerate because it was really big in Indonesia. So there's all sorts of interesting dynamics at play that you can't ignore. Emerging technologies as well, right? Like if you're talking about mobile payments, there's, as I'm sure you've heard, like the kind of leapfrog story of mobile payments in certain places in Africa completely taking over, and not even just kind of going through the whole ATM process, they just completely became mobile focused. And of course, economic forces, right? If you're planning and launching in Turkey, probably a good idea to hold off right now, right? Or maybe not, right? Maybe the kind of the exchange rate is favorable and you can actually secure some content acquisition deal at a favorable rate and that you can lock in for the next 5 years. I don't know. But like, just keep in mind that these things are constantly evolving. So a couple, three additional things before I actually go into the more practical side of things. Mistakes people might make. The first one is forgetting to iterate on a product strategy, or spending too much time on it. One, I just listened to a podcast a couple days ago that was really interesting. Again, this applies not just to existing product managers, but maybe people who want to pursue a business. And actually, this guy who was being interviewed said, he was the CEO of Product Hunt. The first thing he said was, you know, I think a lot of people make the mistake of confusing a project with a business. You can start a project in a weekend, but you can't start a business in a weekend. And you got to decouple those things. Pursuing the project is just as important. And this applies to just a self-starter entrepreneur who wants to do a little weekend project as it does to a product manager who has a quarter that's a little more quiet and can afford to do some more exploratory work. You can get a lot done with prototypes. You can get a lot done with just having good rapport with a couple of engineers in your team, deciding, hey, let's do a hackathon, get a pizza, and then build something cool. And that can have a lot more power behind it and momentum than a 30-page doc can. So once you find product market fit, then you also want to make sure you'll be focused on growing your product, of course, right? Growing, expanding into adjacent markets. But you also need to adapt to the unique needs of the customers. I've touched on this already. I'm not going to be super redundant, but your different markets might have different unique needs that you want to address. And so a big part of it is just making sure that you're on top of how these things are trending and evolving by getting feedback. Right. Keep talking to the customer. Always, always survey. Do any assessment you can. Go there. Speak to people. Go to the field. Understand how they're using the product. If you see someone who happens to have, the app opened on their phone, go and ask them. I do that a lot, and it can get annoying, but it's the best way to understand how people use a product and what are the things that are top of mind, the things that are most frustrating, things that they're happy about, whatever. And learn and adapt your strategy accordingly. And then finally, the company lifecycle is also at play here. You'll have the kind of typical S growth curves. It's very easy to feel like you get to the apex and be like, all right, well, we're done. Let's just put this on maintenance mode and create and put this in a cash cow division. Things will change, and you got to keep an entrepreneurial mindset from a strategy standpoint to really understand how you can be completely caught off guard by some competitor. This happens all the time. Again, YouTube, for instance, we were caught off guard with IGTV, right? The strategy there broadly is they have the social, they can buy the content, so why not merge those in that way? We were thinking about it in the flipped way. We have the content, but we don't have the social. How can we build it? The question is, what can happen faster? Is it harder to build a social graph, or is it harder to negotiate with millions of partners to allow an AVOD, a video ad-streamed kind of content ecosystem? All right, now most importantly, informing this process. This is what this course is all about. Informing the process isn't easy. Just by show of hands, who here is either more in an exploratory product or versus something that's more like corporate, I'm managing something that's existed for a little while? Who's in the first bucket? Okay, most people. Great. Cool. So hopefully this will be useful then. You can do primary research, of course. It's just not scalable. I can try to deploy as many surveys as I want. It's just not scalable if I don't have the money. If I'm actually trying to do some research, there are a bunch of secret weapons, which are basically secondary research. Now, these are my selected 7 most useful things by far. And I'll actually start with the bottom one. Has everyone heard about the Mary Meeker Internet Trends Report? You have, a couple people have. Do yourself a favor and read it. It's 400 slides long, but it comes out every year, and it's basically the Bible of product managers and VCs alike. Mary Meeker is a consultant who does a really, really, really extensive report on the whole state of affairs of the internet. What does mobile look like? What does the shift from TV to digital ad spend look like? What does voice look like? And by look like, I mean everything, literally. She goes through growth, major players, business models, distribution challenges, all these things. But starting from the top, my advice would be the following. If you are in a company that is pretty large, they will probably have access to one of these things. A lot of people just make the mistake, especially when they join a company or when they're junior, to think like, oh my God, I need to do research on the consumption of avocados in China, and I'm going to start by searching avocado consumption in China. Fair, that might be interesting, and there may be some Wikipedia, dark Wikipedia page that, you know, someone actually took the time to write. But if you are in a larger company that has access to these kind of research subscriptions, there are incredibly helpful statistics, reports, and things like that. If you're not, chances are you have a friend at one of these big companies who can share a login. I'm not endorsing this, however, there are ways that you can get this data, either by saying, like, look, can you help me pull this stuff, right? It doesn't have to be shared, the raw data, or a lot of these have free tiers, right? And it's okay to only have access to 3 reports every 15 days, because most likely eMarketer, Nielsen, Capital individually won't have everything you need. Just between them, you'll have a lot of stuff that might be useful. So eMarketer, the pro tip here is, this is an amazing source for stats. If you ever are pitching an idea or whatever to a VC, an investor, or to your director, and you just need to make a case saying like X amount of people watch or listen to podcasts a day. I'm going to pitch a audio-only format on my new product, and I need to know this is how many hours of podcast listening exists in a day, how many people, split by gender, split by whatever. They have this for so many things. I find it hard to believe. They have an army of analysts who will do research on all these top things and produce really nice reports that you can just export the raw data from. It's very clean. Nielsen, if you ever need consumption data in the media world, whether it's about music, movies, TVs, so like ratings, box office returns, number of streams, Nielsen aggregates all this. Capital IQ has almost, if you from finance or management consulting, I'm sure you've used it. Capital IQ has financial reports of all types. They basically take the Goldman Sachs, the JP Morgan, and the Credit Suisse, and they like take all those investor reports, put them into a digestible three, four paragraph format with all the data you need that's exportable in the CSV. And it's just, there's no better way to actually understand what the performance of a large company, especially a public one, is. If it's private, you'll actually sometimes see information that is from weird, not super attributable sources. But I don't know. I've seen information from private companies that somehow ends up on Capital IQ, and it's pretty fascinating. App Annie, for anything mobile, if you need to know what the DAUs, what the retention, what the revenue is for any mobile app, on Android, on iOS, or anything else, they'll have that. It's pretty amazing. These are not obviously from the platforms themselves. This is not Apple giving information. By the way, a lot of this is from panelists who are paid to have a basically stealth app on their phone, and then it tracks everything they do, and they kind of extrapolate that, assuming they have a representative sample. That said, it's usually very... I've compared the App Annie figures with what's on Google, internal Google Play dashboards, and it maps pretty well. So it's extremely reliable if you want to do competitive analysis around apps. Crunchbase, I mentioned someone talk about it earlier. Crunchbase is the de facto VC encyclopedia. What the teams look like, how many rounds of investment they've gotten, who their main competitors are, where they're going, any news, site hits, all that stuff. So if you're looking at more of a less established competitors, Crunchbase is the place to go. And Crunchbase has a really useful free tier. So eMarketer, for example, right? I care about podcasts. This is the kind of stuff. And this is just two out of 40 illustrations on a gallery that they had. These are things that are really easy to just copy paste into a doc. You have the raw data if you wish. And they're just incredible sound bites. And by the way, they complement all these things with, again, a really digestible two-pager that has the TLDR that you can just give to someone. At Banny, as I said, I just went in here, I checked Instagram, and right away I can see, for example, for iOS, split by device, how many DAUs, the open rate, the average session per user, all this crazy stuff. And if I want to then do a little bit of what I'm going to do later and just kind of triangulate a couple of different data points to arrive at something new that I estimate, these things are so, so useful. And Crunchbase, funding rounds for Tesla, you can see exactly how much they've actually received from various investors and who they are. All right, so the meat of the conversation here, a few examples of how I've gotten through a bunch of interesting, challenging topics of kind of getting data that might not even existed. How do I estimate? How do I make a case? Understanding customer needs and behaviors. The first thing is using social APIs. Now, after Cambridge Analytica, it's obviously very different. But I remember I did some interesting research where we were just kind of understanding, I think I was comparing what the audience demographics looked like between Instagram and between YouTube. Obviously, I already had access to everything in YouTube, but I wanted to understand, are users in Instagram a little younger? Do they over-index across iOS? I mean, those were hunches, and I wanted to confirm them. It was, especially, but it still is scary how much information you can get by just tapping into a Graph API. And it's pretty easy. If you have any kind of technical, you don't need to have super coding chops, but it's pretty simple to code up something in Python that will just basically crawl through, go for a page that represents an artist, extract all their fans or like people who like that page, collect a dictionary of all these people, and then iterate through that dictionary to see what other pages do they like, what's their name and location and age. Those things are all public. And you can extract just super valuable stuff, and sometimes it's a little scary, but because by default, like, a lot of these things are public. Using eMarketer, again, I've kind of already explained this, but this is the other approach where they already have so much. It's a treasure trove. And by the way, a lot of these services have dedicated analysts. If your company has a subscription, and again, they probably do, you can just say, hey, I'm looking for information about avocado consumption in China, and someone will actually email you 4 hours back. So I guess the big takeaway here is don't get too carried away in down the rabbit hole of Wikipedia and 70 tabs, and I sound like a complete hypocrite because I do this all the time, but there's so much cool stuff that where data is at your fingertips almost literally, and someone will just give it to you instead of actually looking for it. Quantifying value prop, Netflix catalog scraping. This is an interesting one. I wanted to understand the value of catalog completeness. In catalog, I mean movies, right? As YouTube, we care very much about what our catalog looks like, and as we sought to produce a unique value proposition on YouTube Premium that we just launched, we wanted to understand, well, how much should we really be willing to pay for catalog completeness? So the first question is, what does catalog look like on Netflix? So Netflix is very secretive. They don't really put that much information out there. But the information is on their site, right? So I don't know how to really phrase this, but if it's on the internet, you can get it, right? There's the dumb way and there's the intelligent way. There's the dumb way, which is I'm going to go through their entire catalog, their entire browse, and you know, see all the movies that are out there and have a different tab and switch and go to my Google spreadsheet and see name, title, duration, some interpretation of what the genre is, etc. You don't have to do this. You can very easily build something that basically just makes the same web request, right? I looked at my Chrome, I saw the request that was made when I load a particular image, and I saw, oh, you know what I could use? There's actually the secret list of category codes. Have you ever heard of that? So like Netflix categories, category codes. So like 2 years ago, someone realized that there's these like basically random numbers that represent very, very, very niche genres of movies. Anime, children and movies, like really, really niche, like tearjerkers. And this is public, but it's semi-hidden. And so what I thought was, well, maybe I can just plug this number, right? If I click on this, crime dramas, I'll go in here and it'll give me, right? Oops, yeah, crime dramas. It'll give me all this stuff. So technically, I could just build a script that would just go through every single movie here. And by the way, the JSON response for this Netflix site, even though it's not surfaced to the end user, the actual JSON response contains the name, an ID, a genre, a duration, everything. And so it took me about an afternoon to put these categories here, iterate through them on Python, send a curl request through my terminal, add movies to a giant collection, and write a CSV. And I very, very easily basically got an entire list of the entire Netflix category split by genre, and I can very quickly see, all right, well, Netflix very heavily over-indexes on thrillers. That's what people probably want. Small things like that, right? There's smart ways of doing these things that don't have to take an entire week of just painful manual work. Same with SoundCloud. The question here was, what does a SoundCloud catalog look like? I'm an avid SoundCloud user. I know that I see a lot of electronic music on there that I can't find on YouTube. So, but the question is, for example, how much does SoundCloud monetize, and what does their catalog look like? Do they have a lot of content that's mostly focused on rock or rap or country or electronic music, whatever? Again, it's very shockingly easy how much information these people put out there. And it's a blessing and a curse. As the person who manages, as you know, as if I'm the CEO of SoundCloud, I both cherish the developer community that makes use of, you know, this very open API to create awesome things on it, as much as I despise the fact that there are analysts out there crawling through my entire thing and just, you know, and doing all this. So for example, if I want to know how many users are there on SoundCloud, I can go in and with the API, there's an endpoint that says, given this person ID, get all their friends, right? I can basically just do that with my own ID. I can go in, check the source code, see what my own personal ID is, start that as a seed. And then I can take all my friends, then I can take all their friends, then all their friends, then all their friends, then all their friends. You don't need much more than like 12 hops. I'm not going to count in binary, but like 12, 13 hops to get to over like millions of people. And by the way, if you're doing some analysis of who the users are, you don't need to get an exhaustive sample of users. You just need some, I don't know, but 5 million is a good number. So again, I think that the TLDR is, a lot of data isn't public, but it is. It just takes a little bit of know-how and a little bit of cleverness to actually retrieve it. Same thing here. I can actually say, in that process of fanning out to all of people's friends, I can also look at their entire listen history. That's there, and it's public. I can look at their entire listen history, and then I can look at all the things that they uploaded. And in the process of actually counting how many users are on SoundCloud, I can pretty easily also count how many videos, how many uploads there are, and again, whether their genre, what their genre is, how long they are, whether they're monetized. This is all in a JSON response. If you don't believe me, or the way to do this is just basically saying SoundCloud API, you go in here, usually you have to make a key. Any of you have not used an API before, you go into the documentation, like the API reference, and here you can right away see how to authenticate, and right here, user endpoint. Given a user ID, I can get their username, their country, their full name, city, description, track count, playlist count, followers, followings, how many people they're following. I can even get their pictures, right? So if I'm building like a machine learning model to like do face detection, I could scrape pictures, right? It's all there. It's all public. It's not necessarily terms of service appropriate. You got to make, no, I mean, there's like ethical ways of doing this. Like you got to look at rate limiting and all that kind of stuff. You don't want to bombard things and, you know, just be legal here. But like, there are things you can do to be smart about the data that's available. Is this useful so far? Is this? Okay, great. So quantifying business performance. Another thing, as boring as it is, if any of you are from finance, annual reports are super, super, super rich. They contain so much, they legally have to put out almost everything there. And if you go through the pain of parsing an annual report or the quarterly report, sometimes they do put things in the quarterly that is not in the annual, you can get so, so, so much. You have to, basically, companies are forced to split by business segment. So if I'm looking at, Rosetta Stone, and I'm looking at what their different models look like, and I ask myself, are they making more money from enterprise, or are they making more money from direct to consumer? Say I'm building a language app, and I want to understand what's generating more money on a user per user level. It's there. Like I can actually go in, and unfortunately, it sucks, but like I have to go, you know, 5 years ago, 4 years ago, download the PDF, find the report, pinpoint the data point, and see, calculate the margin on a user, you know, get the total number of users for that segment, total number of revenue, and I can very quickly understand what the market dynamics look like. I can start very easily saying, okay, looks like they're making about, I don't know, $500,000 per user because the military pays for this. Maybe that's an area I should explore, right, versus a $10 ARPU. My favorite, and I think this is a core skill for PMs, is the kind of these Fermi estimations, these bottom-up, top-down estimates. They're not just useful for interviews. They are legit useful for your day-to-day. If you're looking at a bunch of comparables, right, like comps, companies that are similar to yours, you can derive so much interesting stuff from making kind of fair assumptions, or fair slash defensible. For example, a recent exercise I went through, I wanted to understand what the market for language learning in English would be. And so I just embarked on this journey where I said, okay, well, I know that there's this number of English learners. This is some very high-level stat from the British Council, 1.5 billion learners. I know some of those people are from markets that I'm not going to be able to tap into. I know some of these people are from an age that likely won't buy a subscription product. And I start like kind of filtering it through till I get to a segment of users that I actually think is relatively fair. If I have like a revenue number, then I can actually divide by some average revenue per user. And there's no way that I can actually pinpoint this. I can, however, go to App Annie, look at their users, look at their revenue, and kind of compute a global, like a weighted ARPU, right? An average revenue per user. And I can use that as my factor from having some estimated revenue figure into account of users. So it's a lot of intuition, but the more you do this, the better you become at this. And it's just something that I would really encourage you all to try to do, because it inevitably gives you a very good sense for how things in different industries work, right? If you listen to podcasts or if you read Wired, right, like you'll have a good sense for whether the average revenue is for mobile apps is going up or down for gaming versus education versus whatever. And you can kind of just use these things in the back of your pocket. Now, real example. I'm going to close with this, but I hope I just leave you with like a real kind of useful thing to show you. I saw some heads like when I said, oh, all you got to do is like code 100 lines of code in Python. Like, I know that's not obvious. It's not easy if you don't have a coding background, but there are some interesting things you can do. So I came up with this scenario this afternoon. I'm actually building a product school competitor, and I want to understand on average how many speakers they have scheduled, lined up, and I might even want to understand who these speakers are so I know who to go after, right? So let's explore how you can actually do some really simple work here. I started by going into the productschool.com event list, right? Here's the events. And lo and behold, they actually have a pretty easy list here to get information from. It's not behind a paywall. I don't need to be logged in. So for me, that's a jackpot, because it's hard to make these kind of web requests that have to be authenticated. That involves a lot more work. But in this case, all the browser is doing is basically converting a bunch of source code into a bunch of rendered stuff. So if I go in here and I refresh the page, right, you can see everything that's being produced. You can see, right, like what I want to say is this is just a server response. And it's very easy to tap into that server response. It doesn't have to be visually through a browser. And so my point, my kind of secret weapon that I want to share with you is the XPath. You all know what XPath is? XPath is a way of representing a content tree in a website, like HTML, but in a way, in a kind of shortcut. And I'll show you what I mean. Now, I could basically just go in here, look at the source code, and where's the source code? Whatever. Look at the source code and parse it, right? If you know some HTML, you know that you can just basically look at all these things, and you very quickly identify that each of these things on the right here, each div corresponds to a different event, right? And contained in each div, there is some extra information. Where am I looking at? Yeah, some extra information that contains this card event here, contains a list where each row contains a bunch of things. And so if I want to create a database of all the events that Product School has, and I want to keep a tab on my competitor, I can show you how to very easily build a script that will just, I don't know, auto-generate a list of all this, of all the events. The way I do this is with XPath. So the hidden trick here is, import XML. Import XML, what it does, what does it do? It imports data from structured data online. It's kind of like, that doesn't really mean anything. Let's see what the parameters are. It takes a URL, I just put hard-coded it here, and it also takes an XPath query. As I said, XPath just refers to a way, like a shortcut way of describing what element in an HTML tree you're looking at. So I don't want to get too technical. The way that I want to kind of show this is basically here going into the pre-prepared thing. All right, let's go in here. Let's say that I want the name of the event. Where is this actual text, right? This text lives in this event, in this element here. It's an H3, so like a header a small header, and a class called PS event title. So the way to do this is essentially, I have it here, I'm going to cheat, but I'm also going to describe what it actually is doing. The way to do this is to, you can read about XPath online and you'll see what I'm doing here. But essentially I'm saying, look at the root of the document by slash slash, take H3s, take all the H3s, which is all these like headers, then of type class PS card event title. And almost like magic, you'll see that what happens when I put in my URL and then my XPath, I'm just going to hard code this. There you go. It was really fast, right? It just made one request to the website. It parsed the entire thing, right? Now, let's say that I want to explore, I want to get the date, right? Again, the date is here already, and it's reliably structured. Assuming it's reliably structured, you can always do this. Let's explore where the date is. It's in, where is it? Tuesday, no. Okay, here. So it's in a element type span with class li text. Let's see what I did earlier here, just to make sure that I'm not screwing up anything. There you go. Oh yeah. Let me see. Let's zoom in here. What am I actually doing here? I'm looking at the row where this is contained. See the UL here? And I'm looking at this class, and I'm seeing that this actually contains the information that I want. And so following the same rules of XPath, right, I can take this, right? I'll take this particular XPath that I've defined, where I'm taking, take all these UL elements of class PS card event, and then take the first element of that row. And by doing that, it immediately returns to me the corresponding date. Now, let's get a little bit more sophisticated. I want to also get, we can ignore the date. Let's say that we also want to get the, I want to go one hop deeper, and I want to see what the URL is. Imagine I want to sabotage my competitor and make a script that buys all the tickets so that no one can buy them. This is horrible, but imagine I wanted to do that. I would have to extract the HTML, I would have to extract the link to the Eventbrite, because tickets are not provided by the, they're not provided by Product School. You actually have to click on here and go into the Eventbrite. So where does that data live? It lives somewhere in here, in here. There you go. So in the element type A, which as you might know is like just a link, there's an element A with a particular class that contains the reference to this URL that actually I navigate to that takes me to the Eventbrite, right? This is assuming that the information I want is in this Eventbrite page. So I can take this and I can construct another XPath. All I'm going is going down the tree of elements, if that's making sense, right? I go down the elements and I find in this particular row, I find these particular, I find the LIs, which are just the rows inside that table. I look at the A, which represents that element that I'm interested in. And here I just basically say, look at that element and return the href, which is the URL link. So following the same convention, here you go. I get a list of all the Eventbrite tickets. But what I really want is the names of these people. Suppose I want to now create a database of all the events, but also want the names and maybe the professions or a link to their LinkedIn. How do I do that? It's a little bit more complicated, but this is where the magic of like regular expressions and just a little bit of technical knowledge goes a long, long way. what I can do is do the exact same thing here and look at the source code of the site. I can inspect, and I can see immediately that there is a div of class panel section that includes basically each paragraph that I care about, right? So let's not make it super hard and just pull all the content. The way to do that, again, would be to just basically say, I want to construct a href, right, which is, a XPath. And then I want to import XML. And all I'm doing here with this join function is basically, as you might have noticed, some of these return multiple cells. All I'm doing is just concatenating all these things into a single cell so I can then parse it. So what I get is a list row by row. I didn't copy this. Oops. It's not loading. It'll load it. Oh, yeah, there you go. All right, so each row has some information about what that event is about. But what I'm really interested in is the name. So the name I know is basically, the name I know is essentially contained in, again, a predictable format, which is always meet the speaker and then the name, right? And you can always validate. This is where like just some research helps. I can go in here, look at a couple of examples, and you'll quickly notice that the structure is always exactly the same. It says meet the speaker, colon, meet the speaker. So I can pretty reliably assume that all of the pages have the same structure. And so what I can do with a regular expression is to reference this cell, which I know contains that string somewhere. Here. And I can do regular expression, right? Again, these are super not easy. They're actually kind of complicated and annoying, but they're really useful. I can say, pull everything that has meet the speaker followed by some group, and this is how I create a group with parentheses, of any character, one or more. So essentially I'm saying, take anything that's after exactly meet the speaker and just that, and return that. And so when I do that, I get, I get Dan Olson. I get this other person. And so I can just kind of basically very easily now go wild, right? I have the name. I could say, construct an XPath that references LinkedIn and pulls their profession and potentially their number if it's public. And I can ship that to the business department and say, hey, here's a lead list. Go after these people, or maybe ask them who you could refer because we're looking for speakers. Does this make sense? Like, it's just like a really, in a way of programmatically and kind of intelligently without wasting your time. One of the things I hate the most as an ex-data scientist is just seeing people doing boring, repetitive things. Anything you can do in a computer, if it takes more than, if you're doing it the same process more than five times, most of the time it's worth automating if you know how to do it. So That's it. I hope that was useful. I just wanted to end with something highly practical. And if you want me to kind of give you this exact thing, I can also share it with you. There's tons of content online about how to use this. Cool. And
that's really useful.
Great.
Thank you for sharing.
Yeah. No, I'll share it. I'll reach out to Sam. So like probably go through him, and I'll help distribute the course content and the demo. Yeah. Sorry? Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Cool, that's it. Got some time for Q&A.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Bye. Cool. Any questions? I know it's a little packed. Yeah.
Easy questions. You talk about podcasts. Maybe you have like a couple of podcasts you really like and you want to
put them. Oh, sure. Yeah, I'm addicted. A couple of things that I listen to. I look over. I really like the A16Z podcast, the Andreessen Horowitz. It's the preeminent VC firm. They talk about some cool stuff. The Product Hunt just released a new podcast where they interview a couple interesting people and they talk about, like, what's in your phone? What are these big challenges? If you're into data science, I enjoy, what's it called? Not So Standard Deviations. That's a good one. And I think I would close with Y Combinator. They also have a good one. Yeah. All these are pretty useful just to keep a pulse on upcoming companies, major investments. Oh, and Tech Meme Ride Home. Do you know that one?
No.
Yeah. Tech Meme Ride Home. It's a 20-minute summary of all the major tech news. It's Tech Meme, like a funny meme. Tech Meme Ride Home. That one's fantastic.
And then the second question is, like, it seems like there is a lot of, like, research and exploration involved in what you do, and I was just curious to know how you organize your day and how you even get lost, because I feel like when I have to do, like, seamless research eventually, the day is just gone, and I'm like,
yeah.
What am I doing wrong? And since I work in a small startup, I'm get this practice of what you'd like to share.
I would say just set timelines. Don't be overly ambitious, but set timelines. And not so much in the sense of I'm going to do this by this time, but I'm going to not spend more than 4 days on this. I think for me, that's how I frame it, and it helps a lot. In terms of how to structure, I think it also helps to kind of make a list of the top things you want to question, you want answered, and kind of go after those things individually. And just being mindful of the fact that a lot of this comes with practice and just not getting down the rabbit hole. Or rather, going down the rabbit hole is, I think everyone does it. So, like, not to be embarrassed. Yeah, yeah. It's not like you reach some nirvana where you don't go, when you don't do this. Yeah. Yeah.
So, you spoke about how you were sort of an ex-data scientist. Mm-hmm. That's really training. Can you speak a little bit about the transition from data science to project management?
Mm-hmm. Sure. I see a lot of people doing this, actually. A lot of data analysts converting to PMs. It's probably one of the easiest routes because you intuitively, or you develop an intuition for metrics and KPIs, which ultimately end up being a huge, huge, huge component of product managers in terms of, like, what they do and why they do it. I'm not saying everything is 100% metrics driven, but I think at the end of the day, in big tech companies especially, so much of it becomes a discussion of what we're doing to drive metrics that analysts have a really strong intuition. In terms of my actual process, I went through a rotation. I see a lot of people in Google doing this too. There's kind of a hard and an easy option. The hard option is to just say, I declare I want to be a product manager. And that will force you to go through the same process as anybody else. Going through the rotation means that you actually are embedded in a team that you probably have some relationship to already and work with them for 6 months. And then instead of having, like, something like 8 interviews, you have 4. And, like, that helps your chances. It also allows, wasn't a big problem for me, but I see people who are not coming from a big technical background who might not do super well in, like, a whiteboarding coding algorithm interview, but might actually have, like, a nice passion for coding. And, like, if you give me my time and enough queries and enough tries and Stack Overflow, I'll get it there. Don't worry, but I won't be able to produce in a day. Those people are seen a little bit more favorably ultimately, right? Because they're, like, you can tell that they're problem solvers. You can tell that they can do it. No PM at Google codes every day. And so it really helps with the perceived difficulty of these technical interviews that people, like, are very put off by. Yeah. Cool. Anything else? All right. Thank you so much. Really.
Thanks for listening to the Product Podcast. If you liked this episode, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes. If you want to know more about our courses and next course, visit productschool.com. Stay tuned for the next episode to learn more about the secrets in product management.